Funny Head, the Black and Proud show, and we've got some beers we're proud of, and yes, they're black. And as James Brown led us in with the epic anthem,
I'm black and I'm proud.
I'm black and I'm proud. So this is we decided we were going to go investigate this emerging class of beers, black IPA, and what's the class called?
Cascadian Black Ale, something like that.
Cascadian Ales.
Right. Okay. And so we picked up in our respective places, we picked up a beer here and there, got a selection of black IPAs that we're going to talk about. And I think this is one, though, you got to try, right? We can describe it, but it is definitely a cross. You've got roastiness and you've got hoppiness. And above all, you got the blackness.
Well, take a Russian Imperial Stout and an Imperial IPA and pour them in the same glass, yeah. And that's about what
shake
you get.
Well.
Shake well.
Okay.
Shaken, not stirred.
That's right.
Agitate thoroughly.
That's right. Proper agitation.
And stand back and watch for the mushroom cloud.
Now, we are kicking off our black IPAs with the 21st Amendment Brewery Back in Black, and it's in the can. And I didn't know these guys bottled, much less canned. I've seen 21st Amendments, you know, here and there. I can't recall where, but I saw this when I was in Minneapolis at this wonderful, wonderful liquor/beer store called Zips, Z-I-P-P-S. And if you're in there, you can go to see just a wealth of really good beers from all over, or you can go on twitter.com/bigfoamyhead because Zips is following us.
All right.
Yeah, man.
We knew they had the smarts.
Yeah. They not only twat at us, but they personal message us. So I want to say hi.
I was just at 21st Amendment in May when I was there with my wedding anniversary. Re-celebrating that, and it's pretty close to the San Francisco Wharf.
Okay.
It's a pretty nice brew pub.
That's where it is, San Francisco. I couldn't place where it was. So, okay, so we're drinking their beer. And
nice.
It's a very good-tasting beer. Great way to start off the show.
I thought they did an excellent job. I mean, it's got I love the coffee roast. You get a lot of coffee and roast out of this. And and then you have the little bit of hop pronounced in there. It's just a good, it's a good merger of my two favorite beers.
And when we poured it, it poured a nice head, about an inch head. And we're using these, what are these, like 8 ounce?
These are expensive glasses.
8 ounce.
Don't drop that.
Yeah, only the best quality plastic glassware. But it had a good, it was like the nose was real prominent and then went away.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if it's because we, you know, snorted the hops and it, there it goes. But we both had the same experience, right?
Begs the question, why are you guys drinking out of plastic?
Because the help ain't washing the dishes like
damn
they
that.
Should. Good help is hard to find. Speaking of which, Rick.
Yes?
The assignment for the Big Foamy Head Book Club was to read The Help by Catherine Stockett.
I saw it at Costco, and I just about picked it up.
Just about.
Just about, okay. Mike, you live in a house where that book is found.
Actually, my wife has it out on loan.
Oh, she does. Okay. Yeah. Well, all right then. I read it.
Did you?
I bought it. I read it, and I got to tell you, man, that is a damn good book.
Everybody I've heard said it's a really good book.
I had not heard of it until you brought it up.
Uh-huh.
And I go and I download the thing because you said so. And you said Beth liked it and so forth. So that thing's like number two on the New York Times bestseller list or something. This is Chickie's.
I think I've heard three people say it's the type of book you can't, once you pick it up, you can't put it down.
It really is. It's a really interesting thing because you know how like you read books and you remember from school, you have something in first person, which is I, and in third person, which we're saying you. This is in three first persons, which is really interesting. You got two maids and one white woman. And each chapter, it's like somebody is speaking from their perspective of the situation in first person. So it's really interesting. But the cool thing, right, this is like, ooh, spooky. We were talking about Bessie Smith in the last show. I don't know, 6 pages in, and they're talking about listening to Bessie Smith.
Oh, wow.
Wait a minute. Severed Arm, for people who forgot.
Yeah, that's right. She of the Severed Arm. And we were right. Edward Albee, The Zoo, was the deal, the play or whatever. I don't recall any. I just remember that. Mm-hmm. I mean, I couldn't remember it.
What chapter do they start dusting the furniture?
Chapter one.
Oh, okay. That's
good. Nah, man, they are all on it. And
and it's exciting, too, to hear them talk about dusting the furniture.
It's really, it was really a slice of life. And so I'm reading this, right? And I'm thinking, wow, man, this is pretty bad. And then I'm thinking, well, you know, most of us who came up in the South, that was not uncommon. You didn't have to be rich to have a maid. But in Mississippi, it was kind of the norm, and we're going to talk more about that later on, because I got some stuff. We're going to start our multi-part series on Chess Records, because Rick said so.
I did.
And I tell you, man, there is a lot to it. As I keep uncovering this stuff, it's amazing. And this Black IPA is pretty amazing.
Before we move on, Oprah, what's our book for this week that we won't read?
Oh, man, I don't know. You know, I got so hung up in that. I haven't looked. Actually, I've got some, and I'll pull the titles of some books that I marked about Chess Records.
I was actually calling Mike Oprah, but if you want to own it, go for it, man.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were talking about Oprah herself. I'll tell you what.
Hey, do you know what Oprah did today on her show?
I have no idea.
She quit, didn't she?
No, she invited her whole audience. It was 300-something people to go to Australia. She's paying for the whole ride.
Oh, shit. No kidding. That's like $7,000 ticket.
Yeah.
Isn't she supposed to finally quit and get the hell out?
This is her last year, I think.
Thank God. I mean, she's so overrated.
But,
if there were female listeners, I'd worry. But
I don't think she pays for all these giveaways. I think the sponsors pay a lot of that, don't you?
Well, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, she's loaded, but she ain't that stupid.
Yeah.
Okay, so here you go. The book club assignment, and I'll find the thing, is a movie. Okay? It's called Cadillac Records.
It's a great movie.
Have you seen it?
Oh,
yeah. A couple of times.
I've been wanting to see that for a long time.
Okay, there you go.
And I've watched it 2 or 3 times. It's great.
Okay, I haven't seen it, but what it is, Rick, is it's a close but not accurate depiction of Chess Records.
Mm-hmm.
I knew that, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, all during the, Etta James.
Etta James.
Yeah. Sonny Boy. No, not Sonny Boy.
Yes, Sonny Boy Williamson, too.
Okay.
There were two Sonny Boys.
Muddy Waters. Muddy Waters.
Right. Okay. Yeah, yeah. Okay. And so you're naming them off. Little Walter.
Yeah, Little Walter.
And Howlin' Wolf.
Yep, Howlin' Wolf.
Okay.
That's right.
So it's really, I haven't seen it, but I've got it on order on Netflix, because I'm going to watch it. Because I've been reading all this stuff and doing the research to try and meet Rick's expectations.
And Beyonce plays Etta James.
Yeah. But
she looks funny with the blonde hair, you know, real short blonde hair.
Yeah, well, I mean, she looks like Etta James.
Well, I think she looks a hell of a lot better than Etta James.
Well, yeah, probably so.
I'm sure whatever Beyonce dressed like, she looked fine.
But I looked at
the junk in that trunk.
I looked at the guy who played Howlin' Wolf, because I saw like a YouTube video clip.
Uh-huh.
And he's like, damn, this guy's good.
Yeah.
It's like, who is this? And he had some weird name, and I go look him up. It's like, he's sort of familiar, but I couldn't place him. You remember this show, and I don't know if it was Showtime or HBO, called Oz, about the prisoners, and you always had all these, you know, prison rape scenes, which are quite disturbing. Do you remember this bald-headed black guy that wore this little tiny hat? Looked like a toy hat?
Uh-uh.
Well, that's the guy. I was like, oh, sure. It's the guy. But he does a real good Howlin' Wolf thing. So there is a soundtrack for Cadillac Records. Mm-hmm. I got the soundtrack of the original Chess recordings and am doing like a side-by-side. And the Chess Records guys, they do a pretty good job, but they aren't original.
Uh-huh.
And the interesting thing was Little Walter, who's become a personal favorite now, nobody sings Little Walter because they couldn't, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we're going to get on more on that. Rick, your beer, did you say it was a double IPA or it's an imperial IPA?
I've got the Alaskan Black Double Black IPA, and it's a Black Imperial India Pale Ale with the Pilot Series Limited Edition Specialty Beers, and it's 8.5% alcohol by volume, and lots of good stuff on the interwebs if you want to hear about it. It's the Black IPA, also called Cascadian Dark Ale or American-style India Black Ale, is a relatively newcomer to the craft beer world. We may not know what to call it yet, but we do know it's dark and hoppy, and we can't get enough of it.
Well, there you go. Yeah,
has some glacier-fed water.
Mm. Yummy.
It's good stuff.
You know, where is this going to go when you know the reason this style is becoming important, popular, because it's the best of both. I mean, and okay. I think when you it's kind of like anybody that gets involved in the craft beer scene, what happens? You start out where? You drink a Blue Moon. You drink the light stuff. And then next thing you know, you graduate to a Sierra Nevada.
Mm-hmm.
Then you graduate to or maybe a Nut Brown Ale, then a Sierra Nevada. Then, you know, you see where I'm going.
Yeah, here? You start reaching out.
Yeah, and this is like kind of like the next step. And what's the next step going to be? The Tactical Penguin?
Yeah.
I can tell you where the end point is. That's when you buy a case of Dogfish Head 90 and have a pool party.
Yeah, that's pretty much. I'm still getting heat over something that happened. Was that 3 years ago? Yeah, that's when your craft beer ways get the better of you and everyone around you. That's right. That was epic.
Ever seen a grown man cry?
This one has an original gravity of 1.087 and a bitterness of 70 IBUs, and the color is a nice dark 102 SRM.
Now, this one is 8.8%, and it is 65 IBUs. So these are, style-wise, they're in IPA range, right? Now, ours just says black IPA.
But do they fall in the color range?
Well, I don't know. You know, Rick, that's a good question. Is color or the SRMs, yeah, is that part of the judging? I know appearance, but is color a criteria for deciding a beer style? I wouldn't think it would be.
Well, no, it's part of the style, yeah. But, I mean, judges, unless you have a style or an SRM guide with you, you're not really going to know, you know, is this a 70 or 80 SRM?
Yeah. But can't you look at that beer and tell it's not in the style?
You can, but what, after 40 or 50 SRM, it's really hard to distinguish because it's just getting darker and darker, you know?
So I was talking more of the Cascade Ale. I mean, the black ales,
they're not. But that was where I was going to ask the question, okay, could you technically have entered this in the IPA category? I would say no because it uses roasted malts. Would that be fair?
Yeah, I think you would have a hard time winning an IPA competition with a Cascadian ale.
Right. Mm-hmm. So this would have been previously found under what, like specialty class or?
Barley wine?
Certainly either of those. I would have gone more of a stout range with this Alaskan because that was the initial feeling I had. It was kind of approaching a Russian Imperial stout, although it wasn't malty enough.
Mm-hmm. So do you think maybe people started jerking around with stouts and porters and then they said, well, let's make this thing a little hoppier and then let's cut back on the malt a little bit, and it kind of gravitated towards an IPA? Be interesting to find out.
Well, I read the article in Zymergy, not this last issue, but the issue before, and they were talking about they just started hopping the dark beers.
Oh, yeah.
And some of the darker beers up in the Northwest, they just started hopping them, and it kind of evolved into this.
Okay.
It's a very interesting article. There's a lot more to that, but there you go. Go ahead, Rick.
Yeah, we have to remember that dark is just a color, so you can actually get a darker beer without adding roastiness or bitterness, because there's de-bittered Carafa, and there's Cinnamar, which is kind of just basically a malt-derived dark color additive, you know? Uh-huh.
Well, so, these are awesome beers. I mean, I brewed that black IPA from Northern Brewer, and I will definitely do that one again. That's a great recipe for any homebrewers out there. And then there's a lot of recipes on the internet now. I noticed I looked some up the other day, and a bunch of them came up. So there's plenty of good beers out there to brew in this style.
Yeah, and I think, you know, you were right about, okay, well, what next?
Yeah.
And so that will be kind of interesting. You know, the Belgian IPA, not liking that.
Yeah.
I don't think that was a good direction. And a lot of the Belgian quads and stuff are getting towards the barley wine. So, yeah, that's a good question. Mm-hmm. Where might you go? Well, why don't we take a minute and mention Little Walter, and we're going to listen to the song from Little Walter called Last Night, found on both the Chess Records, Best of Chess Records, and on the soundtrack from Cadillac Records.
Last night, I lost the best friend I ever had. Last night, I lost the best friend I ever had. Now you've gone and left me. You know that's gonna haunt me so. I have blues with a feeling. That's one thing I can't describe. I have blues with a feeling. Well, you was my first love, and you should have been my wife. I want you to call me tomorrow, baby, tell me what's going on wrong. I want you to call me tomorrow and tell me what's going on wrong. I wonder why did you leave me? Baby, please come on back home. Baby, and I don't care what the people say.
And
how little was he?
Little, you know, I don't know why they call him Little Walter, because he wasn't that small. That was a blues name, though.
Yeah, kind of like blind and Mississippi. Well, and
although technically most people ain't blind are. Speaking of which, I saw our boy Blind Mississippi Morris the other weekend.
Cool.
At the festival for the Center for Southern Folklore. I think it's Memphis Music and Heritage Festival.
Mm-hmm.
It was good. The one you couldn't attend. Yeah. But
I heard Alan attended.
Yeah, he did, and it attended to him. he was drunk and hooting. He was in fine form.
Lovely.
So it was a concert with Alan then.
It was. But it was a festival with Alan. So. That was good. And a lot of good blues, and I actually have some field audio I recorded there that I'm going to play as the exit song. I'll go ahead and tell you now. The festival was dedicated to Jim Dickinson, whose sons, as we all know, are our favorites, the North Mississippi All-Stars, Luther and Cody Dickinson. And they all do their own thing, right? And so Jim produced, okay, so here's a quiz. What was one of the most famous songs that Jim Dickinson played on? This is before he became a producer. See, he was also a very talented musician before he became a well-respected.
What year?
1964, I think it was.
Ooh.
You probably have no clue.
No clue.
Okay.
I was pretty young in 64.
All right. I'm going to, well, I know, but you hear the song all the time. Okay, here, I'm going to play the song for you. I'll play a little bit of it.
It's a Rolling Stone song.
It is.
Rolling
out. It is. Do you care now? Before I play it, you care to guess? Deal or no deal?
Rolling Stones, Get Off My Cloud.
No. It's actually, okay, I'll give you a further hint. He played piano on this song.
Mm. I'm struggling. How about you, Rick?
There's one where the Stones do actually mention Memphis, so I'm kind of hoping it's that one.
You mean I met a gin soap barroom queen in Memphis?
Exactly.
No. That's like one of my most favorite lines of any song.
Yeah. All right. So I don't know that, but was, I do know that, that Hammond guy was a rat bastard.
He was.
Was that at the Commodore Hotel?
Yeah, he met a Dixie chicken, a gin-soaked Dixie chicken. Now you're mixing all kinds of stuff. All right, here, let's listen a little homage to Jim Dickinson playing with Rolling Stones.
Good.
Song. Very nice song. And so here was the cool part, right? Throughout the whole festival, they kind of mentioned, and like Cody Dickinson did two or three different gigs at the festival. One, he did an experimental project. This was the coolest thing. And I'm going to play it. I'm going to play it next show underneath everything we talked about, because what he did, he gets up on stage, and it says the Cody Dickinson experiment.
Mm-hmm.
So he starts this little drum machine going, whatever. And then he's getting that track, and then he says, okay.
Now, wait up. I think he went, dun, 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 dun.
Well, actually, we'll hear it. So. But and then he starts that again. He tells everybody, he says, bear with me. It's going to get really good. And he starts playing that. And then he lays down a bass track. Uh-huh. And starts overlaying. But what he does is he keeps building
now,
and layering.
Did he do the electric washboard?
He did. He did. I lost count of how many different instruments and tracks, but towards the end, he gets this great big duffel bag, opens it up, and starts handing out tambourines, maracas, and stuff to the entire audience.
Oh, cool.
And gets them to doing something along. And so the end result sounds like this big-ass band playing. It was really
spectacular.
It's just
him up there.
It's just him and the audience. Yeah. So he involved the audience in the whole production. It's very cool. 32 minutes.
Yeah.
That's one song.
That's cool.
So, yeah, it was real cool. And then towards the end of the night, another like new favorite, Ricky, love these guys, Hill Country Review. This is Cody's project with some of the North Mississippi All-Stars and then some new guys. And so they played, and their closing song, Cody and the band played Wild Horses.
Oh, nice.
Very nice. So a little homage to his dad.
The first time I saw someone do that repeat thing where they step on they play a few chords and then they hit repeat and then they play a few more chords and they're overtracking.
Yeah.
That was KT Tunstall, Black Horse in the Cherry Tree.
Yeah.
I saw that live and it just blew me away. So
you mean
it kind of ties together the horses and the black.
Yeah. What, you mean that's a single person?
She has a band, but when I saw her do that, she was she started off that whole echo thing going.
Cool.
You know?
Okay. Yeah. The loop. Well, all right. So what you drinking there? You still on the same one? You got a new one going?
Oh, I'm on the Twisted Pine Hoppy Night. And this is from Twisted Pine Brewing right here in Boulder. And according to Rate Beer, it's a 7% alcohol by volume and 85 IBUs, seasonal beer. So it's pretty nice. It's got a really strong hop aroma. I'm getting like Cascades or some North Pacific hops aroma coming off. But I don't think the body's not thick enough to carry the the hoppiness. So I'm kind of wishing that it had a little more body to it.
Oh, yeah? It's a little thin?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's kind of overrun with hop?
It's got a huge hop aroma, and you kind of expect to have a nice malty backbone to that and some strong bitterness in the taste, but I'm not getting it. So.
Yeah, I know. I've had, and I won't name whose beer it was because I like them, but this was shit. It's like hop juice. I mean, like they squeezed hops in water. There was like no malt. It was horrible. But so we're drinking.
If it was me, I'm man enough to accept that.
Well, I drank it. I didn't say I didn't drink it. It was horrible. But we're drinking Bashaw. Bashaw.
What a name. Where'd that name come from?
Who knows? Them crazy-ass Scots. You know, it's their boys at BrewDog, and their benefactor, Greg Cook from Stone, they teamed up on this crazy thing, and the label is cool. It's the Stone gargoyle perched over and holding the BrewDog shield.
Yeah, it's so great artwork.
Yeah, it's very cool. I'd love to have a black shirt with that on it. Mm-hmm. I want that label. I would wear it proudly.
Bashaw.
Bashaw. So I looked for some stuff on it, and I found a review from our friends at the Brew Site. And it's actually just a month old, so it's current. And it says, last year, Stone Brewing teamed up with Scotland's BrewDog to brew a collaboration beer, and Bashaw was the result, a black Belgian double IPA. And that's its style that they made up. It weighs in at 8.6% alcohol by volume. And dude at the Brew Site said, you might be thinking black IPA, and that's more or less what I thought. But what he found instead was much more Belgian-influenced character without being overpowering. Here's his notes. Appearance, black pour without much carbonation at first, light brown head, deep ruby when held up to the light. We were holding it up.
Well, yeah, that's a stretch.
If deep ruby is brown. Yes.
Yeah. Coffee brown.
Smell, roasted malts with a bit of earthy hops with a chocolate funk that strikes me as Belgian and reminds me of earthy mushrooms at the same time.
Hmm.
I didn't get that. Taste, definitely hoppy, but also spicy up front, peppercorns and radish greens in the mix.
Peppery. I'm getting a little peppery out.
I think so. Raw honey, hops again, follows with a minty green bitter spice. Man, he do talk purdy.
He uses his mouth purdier than a $2 oil.
Yeah. Overall, unusual and tasty, not the assault on taste buds I'd feared. Now, okay, so that's them.
Can you read that?
Hell no, I ain't going to read that.
I can't, but it talks about the Bashaw. What does it mean?
Microscopic text. Buy a bottle, read the label.
Yeah, I can't read it. It's way too small, man. It's fine print at its finest.
So what do you think about this? It's definitely got some interesting tastes to it, but if you gave it to me blind, Belgian would not come to mind.
No. I'm getting a real dry finish off this, and there's not much, kind of like what Rick said, there's not a lot of body, there's not a lot of malt to kind of balance the bitterness.
Is that your dog phone?
Yeah, hush.
Okay.
Hush, doggy, hush. Yeah. As far as the finish, it's just super, super dry. You take a little sip, and you get the bitterness. But right after that, it's just gone, and there's just nothing there.
Yeah.
I do get a little roast.
Yeah. Me too.
A little coffee. Mm-hmm. But other than that, it's not something I would just, you know, clamor to go out and buy.
The thing I was getting when I was drinking it, when it's in my mouth, I got enough of it in as I'm swallowing it, is a little barley wine kind of character.
Yeah, kind of similar.
Not thick, because we definitely agree. Whatever this round, for whatever reason, is the thinner weight beers. Uh-huh. But I like it. It's different. I don't think I'm going to go out of my way to get another one. But
I drank
good.
All mine.
I drank. Okay, yeah, and then drinking all mine, and it went down a lot easier than the hop juice stuff, which is nothing like the beer called hop juice. I know there is a beer out there called hop juice, but all right. So it's pretty good. Okay.
Did you like the other one better?
Actually, you know what? I think so far I did.
Yeah,
I like this. It's interesting. I'm paying attention now to what I'm getting as I drink it, and I'm getting a little bit of different taste. But the finish after by now, as much as we drank, I'm not too wild about the finish now. Mm-hmm. Whereas this Back in Black, I'd drink another one.
Yeah,
you know, I think I had enough of this guy. So good stuff.
I do love the artwork though.
Oh yeah, oh yeah! I'd buy the T-shirt. Yeah. I'd probably drink one more, especially if Greg Cook told me to. Hey, I hope you guys at the GABF at the Croc Fest. I hope he's there. You got to drag the BrewDog guys over and get some commentary, some follow up. You know, because it's been a couple of years. And did y'all know that the end of the world, the beer they made, the 55%. Sold out.
Wow.
$750 bucks a pop, and your choice of dead rodent.
Yeah. Squirrel.
Squirrel or stoat. Stoat.
I want the dead stoat, please, sir.
Yeah. But they're gone. You cannot buy anymore.
And it was what, $750?
Yes.
Wow.
Is that crazy?
Shit. Well, I'm in the wrong damn business.
I know. I wouldn't give you 75 cents for a dead squirrel, but you stick a 55% ABV beer up his butt. Now you've got something.
It becomes your most important squirrel.
Yeah. But it's hilarious, though, when you see it pour because, like, the neck of the bottle is sticking out of the squirrel's mouth. It's like, I got it. That's funny.
You almost feel sorry for the squirrel. Almost.
Yeah. Yeah. But you gotta get them.
He's got a 55 ABV up his butt.
That's right. What's he got?
Things can't be all bad.
That's right. If you got to have a bottle jammed up your ass, make sure it's one that has a high alcohol content. Words to live by.
I think there's websites out there on the interwebs
really?
That you can find similar things.
High alcohol bottle up my ass. Yeah. .com.
Not safe for work.
That's
safe.
Right. I think we just crossed the line.
Yeah. Cut.
Okay. So do you want me to start my chest thing now?
Sure.
You gotta,
yeah,
okay.
Please do.
All right. Well, we'll sit back, get your beer, and listen to this because this is a lot. The chess, you know, we've talked about, I think most everybody in the world has heard of Chess Records. They're not an unknown record, but not everybody knows, you know, who they are. Now, if Mike, you had heard of Chess Records before, right?
Mm-hmm.
Could you have named why you knew about it or who was on it? Or
no, just from artists, you know, on the internet, pulling up stuff and found out they played on Chess Records.
On Chess Records, okay.
And I know about Howling Wolf.
Okay.
That's the most famous.
Okay. Well, he's the most famous that you know, right? Now, did you know what was what we would say is the first rock and roll record? Have we had this conversation? Chuck Berry? Which one?
Twist and Shout, wasn't it?
No, that was a little
Richard. I would say
The Beatles.
The guy down in South Haven.
Huh?
The guy down in South Haven, the killer.
Jerry Lee Lewis, Great Balls of Fire, you think that was? Okay, now, well... There are two records that – now, and this is where it gets a little fuzzy, right? Rock and roll, the term rock and roll, is a blues term dating from the 30s.
Hmm.
Now, what was kind of where you saw, just like you're talking about, the styles diverge, where rock and roll became a genre all to itself. There were two records that were pointed at typically as one of these was the first true rock and roll record. That's All Right Mama by Elvis. Or Rocket 88, which is what you're thinking of, the Chuck Berry song.
Mm-hmm.
That was actually done 6 months earlier by Jackie Breston on Chess Records.
Hmm.
So those two. Right there, neck and neck. And we're not going to get to this show, but the pivotal year for all this was 1954. Shit blew up.
I was going to say that.
You would not believe what all happened in 1954. It's amazing. Okay, so let me get into part one of who knows how many of this whole backstory and how we got to where we are today. So last show, we talked about Bessie Smith and Highway 61 as history. In this show, we start to look at where that highway led and why so many blues legends came from a single state. Virtually the entire Chess catalog came from Mississippi, from the Delta. So in the old days, this highway, Highway 61, led to the big city with its charms, culture, opportunities, and class. And, of course, we all know we're talking about Memphis.
Memphis.
All right. Yeah, we really are. Back then, that was the place to be. Beale Street was jumping. You had radio stations in Memphis. You had WLOK, WHER, or WHRK, and you had across the river in West Memphis. You had radio stations there. You had the Cotton Club. You had all these happening places that if you were a blues musician and you wanted to get some fame and exposure during the 30s and 40s and maybe a record deal, you came to Memphis. Okay.
It's the bluff city, and it's hardly ever been wiped out by a tornado.
That's true. That's true. We suck when it comes to yellow fever. But so you got to look back, though. In order to see how this came about, you got to look back at the conditions that existed, the history of them, and why so many black people ran like hell to get out of Mississippi. To see that, you got to go back to September 22nd, 1862. That was the day that Abraham Lincoln issued the executive order known as the Emancipation Proclamation that abolished slavery. It didn't quite take. January 1st, 1863, Lincoln issued the second order of the Emancipation Proclamation, specifically directed at the 10 rat bastard states known as the Confederacy.
The Confederacy, yeah.
Because they had not returned to Union control. Right? So we've got the Civil War happening. We got this going on. Now, here's the interesting part. I didn't know this. Tennessee was not one of the 10 states. We were already under Union control.
Wow.
So the Emancipation Proclamation to free the slaves was not directed at us. We'd already complied. Mississippi did not get the memo. they didn't care.
Their telegraph machine was broken.
Yeah, they were out of the office that day.
But I will tell you that the Memphis email. Area has a really rich Civil War history if you go down to Shiloh. And then Collierville actually has a monument, at least, to some battle.
And we've got on the bluffs, and this is where one of the rare Civil War submarine battles, the Ironclads, were fought. Right. You can go sit and look at it.
I was reading an article in Delta Magazine just the other day, and it talked about the Sultania or Sultana is a big boat, a river boat with the paddle wheel.
Yeah.
And it had it could only carry like 600 or 680 passengers or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And they had 2,800 on it.
Oh, piled up on
it. And it came from Vicksburg. And it had a lot of the Union soldiers that were prisoners at the time.
Uh-huh.
And then when they got released, when the war was over, they were going back up north. And they loaded up this boat, and it had a bunch of boiler problems, and the boilers blew up, and it sank. And it is the largest maritime disaster
today
in the U.S.
Wow.
More than the Titanic. Over 1,800 people.
Well, it's like the Battle of Shiloh. I looked that up. I know we're getting off topic a little bit, but because I read something, I thought, you know, this is a bunch of bullshit. People forget. They were talking about, you know, Afghanistan and Iraq and the number of people killed. Okay. Yes. I mean, it's bad that anybody's killed in any war. We'll stipulate that. But the Battle of Shiloh, and I'm thinking, man, this wasn't shit compared to the Battle of Shiloh. Yeah. And so I went and looked it up. Now, this is the interesting footnote. 23,000 casualties in a two-day period. Now, what does that mean to you?
It's a lot of children without daddies.
Okay, but here's the thing. It's not dead people. That's what I thought. The actual number was like 3,500-something dead, 1,800 or 1,900 missing, and maybe at the bottom of Bloody Pond. And then the rest were wounded. but they're counted as a casualty of war. So apparently, I didn't know this, a casualty doesn't mean you're dead.
Yeah, it's not a fatality.
Yeah. I always assumed casualty meant you're dead. So anyway, it's a shitload of people in 2 days.
Well, I'll tell
you
what, though, you know, you get these people back then.
We digress.
Back then, when you got a bullet wound, you died. You didn't die from the bullet wound. You died from the infection that set in a month later. You ended up dying.
Because
there's
a 50 caliber mini ball tore through your ass, left a baseball size hole on the exit. Yeah, that might hurt. Okay, so back to
It's just a flesh wound.
Back, a lot of flesh and a lot of wound. Okay, so Mississippi tolerated President Andrew Johnson's Reconstruction because Lincoln was dead by then, but no federal money came to Mississippi, so life basically went on exactly as it had the last 100 years or so prior. The freed men were still essentially slaves working for almost non-existent wages. And Mississippi has some really sneaky-ass lawyers and people in the government. They passed what was called the Black Code and then later the Mississippi Code, and they were state codes that were unenforced by federal government that continued to keep the black man impoverished, illiterate, and for all intents and purposes, still a slave. So when Alan Lomax and his daddy wanted field recordings for the Library of Congress in the 20s and the 30s, they went to the fields and prisons of Mississippi because it was the same. It had virtually not changed at all. The Depression era made things even worse. The 1935 wages for Negro plantation workers, 10 cents an hour.
Wow.
So remember we talked about Bessie Smith thinking $30 a song, or we go, oh, 30 bucks a song. That was a buttload of money. But, and this is the thing about, I mentioned about illiterate, the illiteracy rate was 95% in Mississippi. The reason? Because according to Mississippi Code, you could not own land, vote, or do many, many other basic civil rights unless you could read.
Wow.
They didn't go out of their way to teach the black man how to read. In fact, they did everything to make sure you couldn't. So, despite that, few people got through and went to college and got educated. In 1886, that's 1886, Negro teachers were paid $27.40 a month. This is in Mississippi. By 1939, the monthly salary had risen to $28. 60-cent raise over a 53-year period.
Wow, man. Unreal.
Can you imagine? So it's easy to see why, A, there'd be an awful lot of material to sing the blues about, and B, why Memphis sure enough looked like the promised land.
Memphis and North, actually.
Yes, yes. And so World War II came. Things changed dramatically because, you remember, there were not a whole hell of a lot of black soldiers. Even in World War II, by that time, Memphis was still a destination, but to your point, Rick, industrialization in the North brought a shortage of workers, and many black folks left the hard life of the plantation, which still operated, in the 40s for better wages and better treatment to the North, a little further up Highway 61
to
Chicago.
So that's when we imported Mexicans.
You know, the Mexican population of Memphis is a rather new thing.
Yeah.
It is. We're still fascinated by that. But love the Mexicans. Love them.
Love every one of them.
Oh, man. I do. They're the best people. You know they are.
Andale, andale.
So, 1960, in the Highway 61 in the 40s, you had people going to Chicago. And this is what started this critical period of music. Because you got to look back. In the 20s and 30s, Northerners had kind of been hearing this. They called it race records. And what it was all the Delta music, the blues and stuff. They liked that sort of thing. Alan Lomax and his daddy getting these field recordings, bringing it back north, Library of Congress. And the record companies were buying these things up and paying like next to nothing. Oddly enough, and we'll talk about this later, women were the predominant blues singers, not men, which is not at all the case these days. Women blues singers is kind of an anomaly. And one of the first official blues recordings was like Crazy Blues, and I forget the lady's name, but it was in the 20s, right? Issued by OK Records, who was one of the huge ones. Okay, so Highway 61 takes us to Chicago. They loved the Race records, and they started really getting into the Delta blues, also known as the rural blues, in the 30s and into the 40s. One guy shows up in Chicago, Morganfield McKinley, otherwise known as Muddy Waters. He lands from, and he comes from the Stovall Plantation just outside of Tunica, Mississippi. Goes up Highway 61, gets to Chicago in 1943, and he's playing his Delta Blues, and he's scuffling around playing gigs in Southside Chicago. And the place to go in Southside Chicago in 1943 was the Macomba Club. And it had letters 10 feet tall, said Macomba. Don't know what that means. Owned by two brothers, Phil and Leonard. I was stumbling for a minute there. The Black IPA is kicking my ass. Phil and Leonard Chess. You know why they were there? Because the Jews had to live there too.
Okay.
Yeah, they weren't that thrilled with the Jewish folk back in the 30s and 40s. They'd come over in late 20s, grown up there. And
the Jewish are also responsible for basketball. They were the primary basketball players back in the day.
There you go. Well, so the deal was these guys, the Chess Bros, they operated a liquor store, and they saw these clubs around making money, pulling people, and said, well, hell, we're going to open us up a club. So Phil opened the club. He was like the club, running the club and stuff. And then Leonard came in and running it. And they kept seeing all of these guys who would show up their club, like Muddy Waters, and record scouts haunting the place and signing these guys up. And so it occurred to them, well, hell, maybe we ought to look into this record thing, because entertainment was open, one of the few occupations open to the Jewish faith. All right, so the Macomba was a club, and that's where Muddy Waters started playing there. And they said, well, you know, it's kind of loud in here, so you need to do something to, you know, your guitar. We can't hear you. Delta blues, right? Slide guitar stuff. So Muddy Waters more or less single-handedly introduced the new kind of blues called electric blues. That's where that term comes from, is from there. Okay, so I'm going to take a break on that and play this classic Muddy Waters song, and this is one from a little later on, again in that pivotal year in the 50s, but this is a song from the Chess Records recordings that they do on Cadillac Record, our book/movie club assignment. All right. And it's a song you might have heard.
The gypsy woman told my mother before I was born, you got a boy child's coming. He's gonna be a son of a gun. He's gonna make pretty women jump and shout. Then the world wanna know what it's all about. But you know I'm here. Everybody knows I'm here. I got a black cat bone. I got a mojo too. I got a John the Conqueror. I got to mess with you. I'm gonna make you good. Lead me by my hand. Then the world'll know I'm a hoochie coochie man. But you know I'm here. Knows I'm here. on the 7 hours, on the 7 days, on the 7 month. The 7 doctors say he was born for good luck, and that you see, I got $700. Don't you mess with me, but you know.
Was Muddy Waters, Hoochie Coochie Man. Do you know what a Hoochie Coochie Man is?
A player.
I got to quit giving all these damn tests.
It's a player.
That's a good, actually, that's close. Mm-hmm. The Hoochie Coochie was a dance.
Oh.
And that was popular.
Certainly.
Popular in the darker communities because it was very sexual in nature.
Dirty dancing.
So them prim, proper white girls wouldn't do that. But typically it was only the woman who danced the Hoochie Coochie. So Hoochie Coochie Man was somebody who watched it.
Oh.
Right? So I'm a Hoochie Coochie Man. But if you listen to the very first licks, because that's one of the most recognizable things, that lick. You notice there's a harmonica leading it in, along with a harmonica, a drum, and a guitar. And I don't know who it was playing the harmonica, but I got a suspicion it's one of the cats from who was around there, Little Walter or Sonny Boy Williamson or something. So at the festival, our buddy Bobby Rush was the headliner one night. And if listeners have not heard the Bobby Rush thing, go to BigFoamyHead.com, search for it, listen to it. Because you recall, he talked about back in the day, how hard it was. Well, while he's up there on stage with God and everybody, he shared two interesting facts. Now, if you go to Wikipedia and pull it up and read the Bobby Rush thing, or if you go to other Bobby Rush sites, places, there is a confliction on his birth date. It says either he was born in 1940 or he was born in 1936. 4-year difference, right? Bobby stands up there, but the date, November or something, I forget what, his birthday, no discrepancy on that, just the year. So Bobby shares with the crowd, and he's like putting on a show. He's jumping. He's getting around with them thick women that he's got up there doing like he do, and says, I'm telling you, I feel great, and I'm going to be 77 years old. So, you know, I started ciphering on it and realized that both dates are wrong. Huh. He was actually born in 1933. So, everything on the interweb is wrong.
Maybe Bobby doesn't know.
But this makes more sense because of the second thing he said. And he starts talking about how, and this is covered in Wikipedia, he was one of those people who went up Highway 61 and went to Chicago. And he played around Chicago. He never quite hit it big there, but he did play, and he got a lot of, you know, he got a lot of songs in there, and he's obviously a talent. But he talked about one of the big mistakes he made because he played around Chicago and everybody knew everybody. And he said Willie Dixon offered him a song in 1951 and he turned him down. Kind of kicks himself in the ass every day. And he said, let me play the song for you. And he starts playing it on his harmonica, Hoochie Coochie Man. That would have been his song. So it's like, yeah, you screwed the pitch on that one, Bobby. So that was like a huge, huge record. It put Muddy Waters on the map, and it took Chess Records just skyrocketed that. They released that. They also released Rocket 88, and they had a bunch of other stuff that we'll cover next show. And it's just, it gets amazing.
That's an example of the wrong guy at the right place at the right time.
Yeah, yeah. You read about that stuff, you know, and it's like, damn, you know. But it was funny because he was like talking to the crowd and telling them stuff and rattling off these things. And I'm thinking, I wonder how many people even know who the hell Willie Dixon is. He's throwing this stuff out, right, real casual, like, well, yeah, Willie came
like
up
everybody knows what he's talking about.
Right, right, mm-hmm. right. And these very pale white women standing next to me said, who's that guy? And I said, that's Bobby Rush. Because apparently I look like a source of information. People
you
ask
do.
Me
you're
shit.
A,
I don't know
fountain.
Why.
You're a fountain.
But how do they know? Have I got that, you know, information desk look about me or something? But the white chicks asked me, and they're obviously from the north, and she said, who's that? I said, that's Bobby Rush. And she goes, oh. And she turns to the other white woman with her and says, we'll see him tomorrow at Sun Studios. And I said, no, you won't. He ain't a Sun Studio guy. And she goes, well, who is he? I said, he's a damn blues legend.
Yeah.
I said, and I proceeded to start telling them more shit than they ever wanted to know. She's like checking her watch. I got to go. Left the kids on the stove.
You should have said, hey, Bobby, you got a project right here. Yeah. Get her up on stage.
He was a hoot, man. He was jumping up and down and just
Did he pull out the big old panties?
He did. He did. You didn't see that, Rick. It's hilarious. You talk about his big fat woman. And he loves him a big fat woman because she gives you shade in the summer and keeps you warm in the winter. And he pulled out these great big drawers.
They were 3-4 feet wide. They were huge, man.
That's hilarious. All right. So we got another beer. Oh, our man. Last beer, Black Butte Porter from Deschutes. Deschutes. Hey, good brewery, too, aren't they?
Very good.
And
from Bend, Oregon.
Bend, Oregon. You have to pause between that so nobody thinks you're saying something.
Right.
Bend, Oregon.
Got a picture of the mountain and the sun coming up behind with a little bit of green cedar trees out in front.
Is that what that is? Okay. Mm-hmm. Can you read any of that? Okay, so I'm going to read it. Dark and distinctive, like God, I already screwed up. Dark and distinctive, like Black Butte itself. Black Butte Porter. It uses chocolate and crystal malts, crafting a rich, approachable porter. Settled on the banks of the wild and scenic Deschutes River. Scenic. I knew what I was saying. The scenic Deschutes River. Deschutes Brewery's handcrafted ales are naturally made with pristine water from the Cascade Mountains, yada, yada, yada. Okay, so they got into just the basic splooge. So it's a porter, and Rick says he's anxious to know because he's had it before. All right, so Mike, what are your thoughts?
Well, to me, it's not just overly impressive. It reminds me of, dare I say, a Newcastle.
Well,
I mean, a nut brown ale is what it reminds me of.
I'm not a porter fan, usually, because I look at it and I expect a stout, and it's watery.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a porter.
Right.
It's like a, you know, a hybrid beer anyway, and the blending, et cetera, et cetera. So the porters we get today aren't really porters like back in the day, right?
And to kind of defend this beer, we probably should have had this one first.
Yeah, you know, that's a good point, because we had some, they weren't hop bombs, but they had hops. This is okay, but I think it's like a little watery, weak in the coffee, kind of roasty thing. It's there, but it's like, I wish this was, what's our second kind of not so thick bodied beer?
Mm-hmm.
It's not the worst porter I've had.
No, but
it's okay. I'm going to drink it all.
I don't think if I saw this in a store, I don't think I would just go out of my way to buy it.
No, and the finish at the end, and maybe it's me, but on porters and stuff, I got a little mustiness on the very tail end of it. It's like, yeah. Is that like a little dust?
Didn't we come up with a new term a while back?
Yeah. What was that? Not cellar. What was it called?
Under the
basement.
Porch.
Basement.
Under the porch or basement or something.
It was something like that. Yeah, we did have a new word. Man, that was the word. It wasn't that bad. But, no, I mean, it's okay. But honestly, I think I get that out of a lot of porters. And
Yeah.
I don't know. It's just like, it's like, oh, you know, swing and a miss.
Yeah, it's not a bad beer. I mean, I drank all of mine.
Yep, all mine's gone. There's a little bit in the bottle. Would you like it?
Yeah, I'll
take it. Okay, see, you did take some more. Okay.
It's pretty good. But
it's a porter. I mean, you can't really not have a porter, but I agree with you. I see Deschutes a lot, and I just don't buy them.
Now, all right. Now, Rick, per style, from the history of the porter is the, what is it, the whole butt, the three threads that you're supposed to take like a stock ale and a... And it's like a mixture, a blend, kind of like an American lambic-ish sort of thing. You're blending your beers together to make this, which was used to give to the porters in London.
Exactly. Right? It's a, it's to give away. It's a cheaper beer, but it usually is a blend of three different styles. And you should have a little bit of sourness to it. I mean,
yeah, from that's the stock ale, right? Or the old ale or stock ale. So I guess my question would be, does anybody do that anymore?
Not to my knowledge. I think everybody brews a porter, and it's brewed specifically for the purpose. It's not like the old days where they had their special best bitter and their, you know, the party guiles and all that, where, you know, they take different runnings from the sparge and brew from it. I think nowadays people are brewing porter specifically as a porter.
And see, that just to me sounds like, well, we just took the name, because it's not really like what a porter was, which, who knows, it might.
But they're using the malts and the hops and everything combined to make the flavor, you know.
Now, have you had an Anchor Steam small beer?
I don't think I have.
That's kind of like what you were talking about, Rick, with the runnings. The second running of through the malts, they use that in brew, is called an Anchor Steam small beer. And it's kind of got this kind of watery, you know, like second time through the coffee grounds sort of taste.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I'm getting.
Well, you realize these beers in the old days, basically it was safer to drink a beer than it was to drink the water, because you had cholera and all sorts of nasty stuff in the water.
Yeah.
And the alcohol in the beer made it safe to drink. So you really were drinking a low alcohol beverage, and it was sanitary and safe, and you could still work during the day. So they were supposed to be low gravity.
Yeah, true. So I didn't even look at the ABV on this thing. I'm looking on it.
It's probably pretty mild, didn't you think?
I'm looking on it. I got nothing. I don't know where it is. Yeah, but it sure didn't taste very high alcohol. So,
you know, this would go good with a, what do you think, just hamburgers, hot dogs? I mean, this would be a decent summertime beer.
It's about to go good with jerky.
Yeah, beef jerky, peanuts, you name it.
From Old Trapper.
OldTrapper.com.
Official jerky sponsor.
This can be bought at your finest jerky stores in the country.
That's right. That's right.
How about with an oatmeal or a gruel of breakfast, because you're drinking it and you don't want to get cholera?
That's why I was saying, it's disinfecting you from the inside out.
Please, sir, can I have some more?
Survival of the fittest, man. If you didn't have beer at breakfast, you probably wouldn't survive.
That's right. And if you had enough beer, you wouldn't care.
But, you know, was the porter, we talked about this before, about the porter being the poor man's bread, you know, the working man's bread, when he would.
Yeah. That's Egypt. That's back in Egypt.
Yeah. Well,
they used to feed the slaves beer. Yeah. I think that's where you.
No, I was talking about the porter carrying the luggage and whatnot to the trains and loading the trains in England.
Yeah, I think we did say something about, you know, it's supposed to. I mean, it's got carbs.
Mm-hmm.
So give them a little energy. But that's like daiquiris were created for the miners in Africa, the diamond mines, right? To give them something, keep them drunk so they go in there and, you know. Yep, cave fell in.
So they go 3 miles down into the ground.
Let's have a daiquiri.
It's not that hard to carry a suitcase, so I don't know what the porters were complaining about.
Well, yeah. They worked them. They worked them like 12, 24 hours a day, you know?
It's more than one at a time.
Yeah.
Suitcase, that is. Okay. obviously, we're getting all up into our jerky. We're talking about the finest points of porterism. All right, so favorite beer, Rick?
It was definitely the Alaskan. That was beautiful. It was a nice, malty, thick background with it's definitely reminiscent of a Russian Imperial Stout and had extreme hoppiness. And I really am a big fan of Alaska Brewing Company. You know, they make the smoked porter.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
Which and, I have a bottle of in my refrigerator at home.
That's right.
Yeah, that's a porter that they smoked the malt because they were next to a salmon meat smoking plant in Alaska. So they actually have a rich tradition.
Mm-hmm. And it's definitely a keeper for a porter. And that's where, you know, it's not that Deschutes. I feel kind of bad slamming Deschutes because it makes some great beers.
They make some good beers.
But the porter, you know, it's a porter.
Yeah.
But the Alaskan Double Black IPA is well worth going out of your way for.
And I think we are in agreement. Back in black.
Amen, brother.
Yeah, that's good stuff. And the Bashaw from Brewdog and Stone was good, but it wasn't like a go back and, oh, hell yeah, I'm going to get another. The Back in Black was a good all-around beer.
Yeah.
You know? We started it off.
I like the can. The can. I
mean, Yeah. Who knew?
Good stuff. Good stuff.
That's right. More and more of those cans coming
out. Where are these guys out of again? 21st Amendment. You said?
San Francisco.
Really? Yep. Okay.
Good stuff. All right. I hope we enjoyed the beginnings of our musical journey. You know, this is going to evolve. Oh, I got to tell you something. Now, I wasn't able to put it together, but because of all this musical history that we've been covering and we keep referring back to the past, you know, those who forget the past are doomed to repeat it or something like that. So I want to promote, and damn it, I don't have the website, but you can look it up. The Delta Blues Museum in Clarksdale.
Okay.
They have a podcast.
Really?
Yes. And Mike from Delta Blues Museum, I don't have any of his information in front of me because we're going to coordinate this and get together. He has produced a wealth of podcasts for the Delta Blues Museum. So search for Delta Blues Museum podcast or go to the website. You can click on it, listen to it, and they cover all of the music in the Delta leading up to this time where we're starting to talk about and play some music. So we complement each other nicely.
Nice.
So he's going to be on an upcoming show with us and share some of this and kind of fill in some of the backgrounds. And you can hear some of these, you know, I was talking about some of the old music back in the day and, yeah, he's got a wealth of information there, and it's really an interesting thing to listen to.
When Rick comes back to Memphis for Memphis in May, you got to come down a day early, and we go to Clarksdale.
Yeah, we got to.
Amen to that. We've been talking about that for years.
That's right. We haven't done it yet.
Let's make it happen.
All right, and I guess that kind of winds up the show. That was some good, interesting black IPA. And some interesting stuff we got going on. Real good.
Cascadian Ale. It's the new style coming out. And encourage people to seek them out and try them.
Mm-hmm. And homebrewers brew them.
Right. And the next show is going to be bits from the GABF.
Yeehaw.
Yeah. All right. See you next time.
Drive safe.
Come back and see us.